So this is where the relations comes into the picture. The people that I'm partnering with, they have these 30, 40-year-old relationships with land brokers. So we were able to source these nice pocket listings and put them under contract.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Venkat Avasarala is a seasoned real estate professional. His main focus is ground-up development of market-rate multifamily properties and acquiring value-add workforce housing multifamily properties in landlord-friendly Sunbelt states. Venkat is developing 1,500 multifamily units in DFW, Austin, and Phoenix, and he has also acquired 3,048 existing apartment units since 2016. He is managing $85 million in investor equity and has over $400 million in assets under management. Venkat, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Hey, man, the pleasure's all mine, but there's so much to cover here. I'm not even sure I know where to start, but just if you can give our listeners a quick idea of where you started, where you are now, and perhaps how you got there.
Sure. So I'm originally from India, came to the United States in 2002 to pursue my master's in electrical engineering at University of Alabama, Huntsville, the Rocket City.
Right.
So once I'm done with it, couldn't land any entry-level job in electrical engineering because they all moved east to China, Taiwan, and India, so forth. So ended up in IT. So worked at several Fortune 500 companies. My last job in IT career was with Bank of America. I was an SVP there. So yeah, that was my IT career. And that is when I pivoted into real estate. So I was dabbling with real estate since 2007, but nothing serious, just some rentals. I bought about 20 rentals in DFW, nothing much. But in 2016, I saw a quick uptrend in this multifamily space, value add to be exact. So started syndicating properties in mid-2016, mostly in Dallas, Phoenix, and I have one property in Colorado as well. So these are my target areas. Ended up syndicating about 3,100 units, about $300 million portfolio over there. And I didn't use any institutional money. I went and raised from investors, like-minded investors, and I have raised about $85 million so till date. And early last year, just before COVID hit, that is when I see that is existing multifamily, I'm being priced out, right? I mean, I'm being pushed to a place where I'm no longer comfortable paying those 4.5, 5 caps. So I started focusing on ground up development. And I got 3 projects which are currently underway, and then at least half a dozen projects which are in different stages of due diligence, and they're all under call. So yep, that's my story.
Wow. Okay. I love how simple you make it sound. Maybe you can do that for us, you know, throughout this episode, is just kind of break down some of the key steps that you have taken, because even though we're in the Rocket City, this isn't rocket science. So I know that there's certain steps that each of us have to take, but I'm really curious, you know, starting out, how did you said you had 20 single family rentals. Do you still, let's start there. Do you still own those?
Half of them.
Okay. Yeah. Good for you. And then you just realized, what was the tipping point where you said, hey, I'm going to stop doing single family and start doing multifamily?
Oh, that's a great question. So when I was dealing with single family, I'm in direct contact with the renters, right? So I got to write the lease, and I tried using property management, and our interests are not aligned. Property management always wants to put a brand new tenant so that they make money several different ways in the process. So when I realized that, look, I signed up for something that I have to do by myself. And it was okay for a while, but it was just getting too much as you buy more and more houses. When just imagine 20 single family homes, something goes wrong somewhere, right? Somebody's toilet doesn't work. Somebody's HVAC doesn't work. Somebody have a leak. Then I'm the guy who has to coordinate everything. And I was doing a fair job. And I take pride that I provided great customer service. And the proof for that is, you know, my tenants never leave me. Like I have tenants from like 10, 8 years ago, and they're still continue, right? So I'm doing something right, but it's just getting too much. And I'm not bringing a lot compared to the effort that I'm putting in. So that is when I got introduced to somebody who's already doing this thing in multifamily and educated myself on how that works. And it made clear sense. Look, I can put same effort here, and basically by leveraging other people's time, other people's skill, and having a professional property management and working with investors, I can actually lever my efforts to a greater benefit than what I'm getting on single family.
Right. Yeah, that makes a heck of a lot of sense. How did you go out, and when you started educating yourself in this space, at what point in time did you feel like you had the confidence to go out and make an offer on a large property?
See, that's a tough thing, right? Because my background was IT. And barring these small single family homes, I wasn't doing anything in commercial. And that was a very big mental impediment. But after I did my first deal, I was like, well, is this it kind of thing. So what I did is I partnered with somebody who have already done it a few times. Mm-hmm. And I added value by bringing equity, obviously. But more importantly, I was the asset manager for the 2.5 year duration during which we held the property. So I signed up and said, like, look, I'm going to take just third of the comp, but I'll do all the work. Right. I'll be the person, I'll be the guy who will be interfacing with investors, with property management. I'll be the guy who's going to go to the property, do all the work. I just signed off, you know, saying that, look, I'm the be all and end all over there, but I'll just work for 1/3 comp. So that, I bought my way into a property, and that gave me a good 360 degree view on what it takes to acquire, operate, and dispose a property.
Right. I think that's brilliant. That's brilliant. How did you handle the financing side of that acquisition?
Well, that was a small balance Freddie loan. Thank God, man. I mean, we don't give enough credit to these agencies, but without them, I don't know where I would be. Probably I'll be still in my W-2 job, which is not end of the world, but I like where I am right now compared to where it is. But agencies are, I mean, they are unsung heroes, right? I mean, they give us this equity. They're very generous when it comes to the leverage, 75, 80, 80% leverage with very low interest rates and all that. But yeah, my very first property, it was a Freddie small balance loan. I did work with a mortgage broker, and you do need that help from a mortgage broker first few times so that you don't sound like so green and fresh in front of a dust lender.
Right. So you guys had a small balance Freddie loan, but you still had to come up with, what was the acquisition price on the
first? So the very first deal, it was acquisition price was around $3.5 million.
Okay.
And then we put some CapEx, about $4 million and $1.2 million raise. It took us about two weeks to raise that $1.5 million. It didn't take a whole lot. But then again, that's happened because I was partnering with somebody who have done this so many times already, and right. That makes all the difference, right? So we're not learning on my investor's dime here. That's very important.
Right. You bring up a great point there. And I think that's one of the things that a lot of people run into as they're scaling. They go, okay, I've got to get my capital lined up. I've got to get all the moving pieces teed up and ready to go before we hit pull pull the trigger. But it sounds like to you, maybe one of those shortcuts is to find somebody experienced and you offer to do all the back end work once the asset's acquired.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the thought process is, I don't know what I don't know, right? That's the thing. And we cannot take risk on investors' dime. You just can't do that because ethically that's wrong. And you got to live with the fact that you lost investors' money.
Right.
And you don't have to do that. So you mitigate the risk by bringing somebody who have done this several times so that that will diminish the risk that much.
Right. And I think that's key there as well. And then, you know, and as long as that partner understands that, hey, this may not be a long-term deal, you know, this may not happen this way forever, because your ultimate intention obviously was to grow your own company.
Absolutely.
But you're going to figure it out one way or another. So I think finding that key operator is that key partner in the business is awesome. That's fabulous. So at what point in time did you then break out and start doing this on your own?
Well, after first couple of deals, right? The second deal, I brought in the same partner who gave me the first break, because the very first deal, I didn't find it. I mean, no broker would award a deal to somebody who's brand new, right? So as a thank you, so I brought in the same guy into the second deal and gave him a piece, and he doesn't have to move a finger, right? Mm-hmm. So he did very well. So as a thank you. But from the third deal onwards, right, I mean, I'm pretty much on my own. I took in a partner, but basically I was winning one by one, all these deals and able to successfully raise funds and operate the property. It was all good until I would say late 2018, early 2019. And things changed in the DFW market, mostly the prices, right? I mean, now C-class properties have started to sell at 5 cap, which kind of, you know, dampened my mood on that.
Right. Yeah, I can understand that. That's that dampen your moods, to say the least. And I love the fact that you're constantly transitioning or being willing to transition in your business. I mean, you started off, you came to the States, master, you know, electrical engineer. And then you said, all right, well, there's nothing there. We'll go to IT. You did IT. You worked your way up the ranks. You said, okay, I'm done with this. And then I think that's something that, you know, a lot of people want to know what the path looks like all the way to the finish line. But as long as you're willing to keep revising your plan and developing new iterations along the way, you're going to find success. Let's talk ground up development. That's a fun topic. It's something that a lot of people aren't willing to take on just because of the associated risk. But you see opportunity there. Can you walk us through
Absolutely.
That?
Yeah. So again, just to give my specific situation, right, in early 2019, I would say around spring of 2019, the appraisals came out on all the properties. By that time, I'm already holding 3,000 units. And Dallas has been always forgiving when it comes to taxation on the property taxes. Mm. Right. Since we don't have income tax, the schools are funded by property tax. Sure, so sure. They were assessing taxes on 60% on what we paid for the property until then. Right. And then something happened. Now they want a bigger slice. So they started assessing us at 80%, 100%. Well, nobody underwrote their deals that way because suddenly there was a big shift in the way the taxes work in Dallas and we were caught off guard. And now we find ourselves in a situation where the income, the rents are growing at around 3% clip, but my taxes, which is a big chunk of my expenses, is growing at 20% clip per year. Wow. And then comes insurance. And then this rain god keep hitting us DFW pretty hard. And our insurance is even going at 30% every year. So put two and two together, what happens? If your income goes at 3% and your expenses blended grows about 20%, you're in the hole every passing year, right? Your NOI keeps shrinking. So when we realized that is when I quickly understood. And the pricing was getting worse, right? I mean, I was able to buy it until 6 cap. Then came 5.5, 5, 4.5, 4. I mean, where does it end, right? I mean, C-class properties and workforce housing is not supposed to trade at these extreme cap rates that they are doing right now. So I figured that, look, I don't like where this is going. And I figured that we got to bail. And we were hoping to actually sell all our properties in 2020. But then you know what happened in 2020, the COVID came, right? So we got delayed. But anyway, so now that we have recovered, we put all these properties under contract. 2,600 units in DFW are under contract, which are scheduled to close in about another 40 days or so, and we'll be done with this workforce housing. Well, what do you do next? We can always go and buy a Class A property, but Class A are a lot easier to deal with. The tenant quality, the collections, the lack of crime thereof, but they don't pay really well. Right. I mean, not what, and again, I'm not working with institutional investors. I'm working with retail investors, and they would like to see something like 15 to 20 IRRs, which are hard to achieve with the Class A. So I got to figure out something else really quick because I'm in the pivoting mode at the time. So ground up development made all the sense in the world because still, even we are complaining about these high lumber prices, construction materials, labor shortages, and all that. I'm still able to underwrite deals to be built around 6.25 cap rate, Class A, right? In good areas. But you can't buy anything for a 6 cap rate, not even a C-class property, let alone Class A, right? So that gave me a good 200 bips difference between what I can sell this for versus what I'm building it for. And that allows me to sleep at night, right? Sleep at night peacefully that, look, I'm not going to lose my investors' money. And also never been in the history before where there is this confluence of several good things happening all at the same time, namely the interest rates, ultra low interest rates. Then nobody used to lend at 80%, 85%, 90% loan to cost on the construction deals like they're doing right now. There are so many debt funds out there who's going to be willing to write some 80, 85%, which is awesome, right? Which is awesome. Then if you look at the migration, right? COVID Act kind of expedited this migration of people to the Sun Belt cities. So that is the third thing. And then obviously the compressed cap rates, that's the fourth thing, right? So all these things is boding well and telling me that go build, right? Go build. You'll get paid, your investors will get paid, but that is where I have seen maximum opportunity. And then what I had to do is like, well, I didn't have any development background until early last year. But so again, I try to leverage other people's skills. So I partner with developers who have at least 20 years of experience, because again, the same thing I would say, I don't know what I don't know, right? And cannot take risk with my investors' money. So I started to partner with some experienced developers who have done this so many times and then build my resume that way and do all these deals in three different cities, Dallas, Phoenix, and Austin. And again, why these three? I mean, I don't have to explain. Dallas is the leader when it comes to absorption. There is not a whole lot of rent growth here, but if you build, they will come. And it's true, right? Number one in the country, absorption-wise. Phoenix, I don't have to tell you. I mean, there's plenty of absorption, but then again, this crazy rent growth. I mean, it's just amazing. Austin, more or less the same story, right? There's so much migration into that place, and a single family, nobody can buy those single families anymore in Austin. So it's building a good pool of Class A investors who would otherwise want to buy a home, but they can't buy. They're priced out. So they got to have to come and stay with me in my Class A apartment. So that's why I'm only targeting in these. I don't want to spread too thin. So I have partners who can help me build in these three cities. And eventually at some point in the time, I would do it all by myself or not. I actually like this way because I'm getting introductions to good vendors, right? The architects, the civil engineers, the lenders, and all that, working with seasoned professionals. I don't have to start those relations from scratch. I can piggyback on the established relationships that I have, my partner have with all those folks. And also I'm getting access to these pocket listings, these off-market land deals, which are hard to come by. You don't go very far, at least in the near term, buying something on MLS, right? It's hard. I mean, as soon as it's there, everybody will pile up on it and you cannot get it for good price. So this is where the relations comes into the picture. The people that I'm partnering with, they have these 30, 40-year-old relationships with land brokers. So we were able to source these nice pocket listings and put them under contract.
Right. Yeah. And that was going to be one of my next questions is how are you guys finding the land? But it sounds like you've solved, you know, answered that question already. The one thing I would want to know is what did the conversation sound like when you first approached these developers and what did you bring to the table? And I guess, how did you even vet your developer?
Yeah, that's good. So I don't partner with somebody who would just reach out to me on LinkedIn because I don't know anything about those people. And I usually request introductions from my lenders, right? Lenders, title companies that I work with, somebody who they know for years and known to be good actors who would keep their word, right? And it becomes easy to vet somebody if they've been around a lot. Let's say if a developer started like 2 years ago or 3 years ago or 5 years ago, not many people would know that person because he haven't touched enough people to have a reputation yet. But if you work with somebody who has been around for 30 years, vetting becomes easy. A lot many people will know them. And that is one of the reasons why I set myself a 20-year minimum on who I would partner with from the experience standpoint, right? It becomes a lot easier. So it comes with a number one quality introduction. And then the longer they're in the market, it becomes easier to vet. Now coming to the how we're going to approach these developers, right? I mean, if you find yourself a developer who got all the pieces that he or she needs to build and develop these properties, then there's nothing much I can add, right? So I wouldn't waste my time on that. But I want to partner with somebody who has access to land and has the know-how, but not very savvy with raising capital, investor management, and overall the project management skills and all that. So that is where I can come in, right? So, and we can co-develop it together. And also due to this difference, vast difference in the experience, I won't be perceived as a competitor. And I don't want to be a competitor. I like this thing. I want to work with somebody who has connections and who have the know-how and all that and able to build. And also at the end of the day, how you talk, how you keep your word, that will decide how far that particular relationship would go.
How do you structure a deal like that?
Well, we first take care of the investors, just like any traditional deal. And the GP, we come to an understanding with the developer on what splits make sense. It's pretty straightforward, actually.
Right, right. So your developer and you are going to be on the GP side. And of course, all of your investors are on the LP side. So it's pretty straightforward there. What's a typical hold time on a development project? You know, I guess pick one of these that you're working on and like what's your projected hold and projected exit?
So a lot happens before we even show the investors the deal, right? So there is at least a 6-month time before the investors lay their eyes on the deal. Right. So that is like putting the deal under contract and then you have to do your due diligence. And that entails like topographic study, geotechnical study. And then obviously we have to do the market feasibility study. And then you have to go hit up your lender to see what they would lend on, the whole nine yards. Right. So once that is, now we have a deal, we can fund it, we can raise money on it, we feel good about it. And then we show it to our investors. And once the deal funds, we'll close the construction loan. The assumption is that we got all our ducks in a row by that time. Because usually when it comes to construction deal, we don't like these straight splits. Rather, we want to tie it to IRR because construction deals can be delayed. delayed. If they are delayed, we want investors to make more because they're taking that risk coming into time-wise, right? Time-wise, who predicted COVID, right? All the deals which are in the fly, right, in play, as soon as the COVID came, they got delayed, right? So if you set up deals in such a way that you give a preferred return to your investors and set up IRR, investors will be protected from these delays. Obviously, that's a penalty for GPs, but that's okay. I mean, that is how it's supposed to be, so that we have that much reason to get up in the morning and hustle to get things done, right? So anyway, so yeah, once it's funded and we close the construction loan, it's 18 months construction time, and we don't need to wait for the last building to be delivered to start the lease up. So as the buildings get delivered, we can get a CO on that building and start a lease up. So there will be an overlap between the construction 18-month period and the lease up period. So 18 months construction, 6 months additional lease up time, so 2 years, at which point you can actually refi into a permanent loan so that you can reduce your interest rate and start making cash flow and potentially some distributions there in the year 3. Even though we shouldn't count on that, there's a scope to do that. And then wait one more year for the following reasons. Number one, we want to qualify for long-term tax rates, right? So if you wait 1 year before you sell, from that date you get received your last CO, you will qualify for long-term tax rates. And the second reason to wait that additional year is because when you lease up, you give concessions. But when you wait one more year, you get a chance to burn off those concessions and then increase your NOI so much so that you'll net at a higher proceeds upon sale. So 3 years, to answer your question, 3 years. 18 months construction, 6 months lease up, and one more year to burn off the concessions and qualify for long-term tax rates.
Right. That's awesome. So you guys look to exit at the end of that 3 years?
That's right.
Understanding. Okay. Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. You know, and I've seen some variations of this where people will say, you know, they may have two pools of investors. They have the investor pool that wants to exit at the end of year 3. I've seen some, and it's not, I think it's brilliant, but then they take that investor group and say, okay, hey, there's somebody else that really wants to hold for long-term cash flow, maybe a lower return overall, but now they have a class A asset. And so then they basically just sell their deal to their second set of investors just because they already know it. They like it. They love it. They built it.
Yeah.
And you know, it's kind of a wash, rinse, repeat deal where it still stays in house. So, you know,
absolutely. See, my thing is I'm focusing on build and sell at the moment. And because I want to take advantage of these compressed cap rates, God knows when they will expand, right? I mean, there is a possibility for these cap rates to expand again, mostly determined by the interest rates. If the interest rates go up, cap rates have to expand. There's no other way.
Right.
So I just want to build and sell so that I can take the 200 bips that I have between what I can sell for and what I'm billing for. Right. And I don't want to lose that, right? So I don't want to wait too long for whatever reason and lose that. If they expand, I'll go and buy them on the market at later time. You see what I'm saying? I can always do that.
Right. Yeah, 100%. 100%. Yeah. And that also, I've talked to many people who have done that, acquired the same asset more than once, which is always a funny and interesting thing to do. This has been fascinating. And I love kind of getting the inside view on what your thinking is and why you've transitioned along the way. I think that's, and I love just the tools you've given us for how to scale effectively and not burn both yourself and your investors, and also really expand your knowledge base without having to know everything. This has been a blast. I've certainly enjoyed it. Let's jump here into the final four. The questions are this. If I gave you just $20,000 to invest in real estate, what would you do with it and why?
I would definitely put it in some kind of a private placement. And let me tell you why. And again, assuming that you would pick a good operator, because you get so much knowledge. Yes, you can make the $20,000 into $40,000, but then again, you get exposed to how things are done. This is much more quality education than what you would get from a university, and you would pay easily $100,000, not get a tenth of this education. This is the real world education.
Right. You're absolutely right about that. You hit that on the head. If you could help our listeners avoid one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
Well, don't try to anticipate the interest rates too much, right? And here's the context. On all my 3,000 units, I put a long-term Fannie debt, and some had Freddie, but all with prepayments. And right now we're paying through our nose, like to the tune of $25 million in prepayments on our, it makes me puke, right? So yeah, I wouldn't try to do that again. Try to work with bridge loans or short-term loans, or at least it can be a long-term loan, but with a cheaper prepay. That is what I would say.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Those are, if you're listening, that's a $25 million lesson that you don't have to repeat, that Venkat has paid for you. So It's a $25 million podcast right here. When it comes to investing in the world, what's one thing you're doing right now to make the world a better place?
Well, I kind of did quite a bit when we are doing this workforce housing, which I'm trying to pivot away, mostly due to the pricing concerns, not for a whole lot of other reasons.
Right.
I would like to think that, you know, we touched each of these properties and leaving them better than where we find them. We provided nice, affordable, safe areas for people to live in.
Right. No, that's great. That's great. Then, Kat, if a listener want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
They can reach me at my email, Venkat, V-E-N-K-A-T, at Stryker, S-T-R-Y-K-E-R-P-R-O-P.com. And you can use the same domain to visit my website, or you can just call or text me at 281-727-9238.
Venkat, thank you so much. It's been a blast.
Thank you, Sam.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.